Good morning. I am Stephen Furr, minister of this church, and it is my pleasure to welcome you here this beautiful and balmy Independence Day weekend. Though our church is but 70 years old, Unitarians and Universalists were both established at about the same time as the United States in the late 1700s and early 1800s. They were kind of denominational liberal cousins until the late 1940s, when their youth groups merged, foreshadowing an actual merger of the churches in 1961. And ever since, delegates from Unitarian Universalist congregations from across the planet have been meeting every June for an annual get-together. General Assembly, often abbreviated GA, is a lot of things: a deliberative assembly of delegates, a global celebration of shared values, an opportunity for UUs from across the world to keep abreast with one another and up to date, and a collective rite of passage marking another year of shared high aspiration. About 8 or 10 years ago, denominational authorities began making General Assembly available online for people who could not otherwise attend. A few folk began attending electronically, but only a few until 2020. This year, the entire event was virtual. I went mainly to find out what it would be like. I definitely miss the informal get-togethers with colleagues and former congregants that happen just while you're walking around from event to event. But the events and presentations were as meaningful as ever, and through the course of this morning's worship, other delegates will share aspects of GA that they individually found particularly satisfying. My favorite, Howard Bryant, senior writer for ESPN, the magazine, and formerly the Washington Post and Weekend Edition on NPR, and author of Shut Out, a book I read about 15 years ago about systemic racism in sport, especially baseball, and especially the Boston Red Sox. And now he's written another book. He's written about five, but the most recent one, Full Dissidents, about the uneven playing field for athletes of color. And he spoke about that at GA and was very powerful, excellent speaker, and I was moved. Next year, the General Assembly will resume meeting physically in Milwaukee this time, as well as virtually. Perhaps some of you who are worshiping with us this morning will be inspired by what you hear today and start thinking about going to GA next year. I hope so, because you'll have a wonderful time. But for now, welcome and good morning.
I'm Mike Radow, he, his pronouns. I'm also a member of the board of directors. This was my first ever General Assembly, and I will definitely go again. So here's the first strand of today's service that we will let you braid together into something for yourself. For me, the assembly was largely about questioning my certainty, knowing I can't just sit on what I want to believe. Since the pandemic, I've been forced to rethink a lot of things and have tried to accept and even welcome change as a natural and constant companion. Our fourth Unitarian principle says the free and responsible search for meaning. And it says it's an active search. So I'll tell you what happened for me at the conference. Two stories from Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, the author of An Indigenous People's History of the United States. She burst some bubbles and helped me challenge what I thought I knew. The first story, Hamilton, the musical. It's been all the rage. We all know it. It's just come out on Hulu or something cheap. I don't know. There's a song in it, Yorktown. In it, Alexander Hamilton and the Marquis de Lafayette sing, "Immigrants, we get the job done," but it's just not true. Hamilton was a British citizen, free to go anywhere in the empire. Lafayette was a militarist and a French aristocrat who went home after his adventure. So why change history? "Immigrants, we get the job done." Well, that has a new meaning now, and I don't think of these fake immigrants. I think of the Mexican agricultural workers who are called essential but still work in conditions we would prefer not to think about so that our food can be cheap. Ouch. In Hamilton, even though they're black and brown actors playing the parts of white men, the play itself has no natives. Zero. They're made invisible. They were certainly here in 1776. So what's going on here? A free and responsible search for truth. Well, here's another story. In 1960, the new president, John F. Kennedy, burst on the scene announcing that we were a nation of immigrants. He was young, our first Catholic president, and he tried to build unity by saying what? That all our ancestors came from somewhere else. Wow. And again, indigenous peoples are completely forgotten. It's so easy to ignore what we're taught not to see, and it's so easy to forget what we have long ignored. The nation of immigrants, it does further harm. It lumps together all these different groups. Think of the starving Irish refugees in the 1840s, or my own Lithuanian Jewish ancestors, those Mexican farm workers, enslaved people brought over here in chains, and the enslavers themselves. Are they all just equally immigrants? Who am I letting fool me? Makes me wonder. And that's the point. It's good to wonder. Confronting ideas counter to my assumptions is the responsible search for truth and meaning. And it's not just good for my brain. It's good for my heart. It gets me used to adapting and gets me ready for bigger changes if they come. By stopping and intentionally trying to see something from another point of view, wow, it softened my certainties and it opened me up to who knows what. It might just tear down some of the barriers in my own heart. And that's the start of practicing love. Thank you, General Assembly. Let's hear a story now for all ages.
We all know the story of the Declaration of Independence. Britain taxed America. The people got tired of paying those taxes without representation. Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence that begins with the words, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." At the time of the Declaration of Independence, all 13 colonies allowed slave ownership. When it became evident that more soldiers would be needed for the fight, slave owners were allowed to send slaves in their place to fight for the Continental Army. Slaves were then promised their freedom for fighting. This meant that able-bodied young men had a chance at freedom. Seeing this, the British offered any slave that left their master freedom, men, women, and children. In the Massachusetts colony, one woman listened to the words that all men are created equal. She challenged this law in court and won her freedom. Massachusetts became the first state to disallow slavery. Elizabeth Freeman won her freedom, but it would take almost 100 years before all slaves were freed. Frederick Douglass, an African-American champion for justice, wrote to Thomas Jefferson, challenging him on what he meant by his words in the Declaration of Independence. Frederick Douglass wrote, "What have I or those I represent to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in the Declaration of Independence extended to us? What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him, more than all other days in the year, the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is constant victim." We tell the story of Elizabeth Freeman and read the words of Frederick Douglass to tell everyone the contributions that people of color had to gaining our freedom, the freedoms we take for granted today.
Good morning. I'm Amanda Strombaum, and I participated in General Assembly whenever I can, because I always find an amazing amount of inspiration and vision showing possible ways forward for me and for Eshore to grow. This year was no exception. I'll mention a couple of the most inspiring ideas that could help Eshore grow. First was a structured and comprehensive adult education program called Faith Forward, which was developed by the UU Church in Dallas, Texas. And it can help members learn in depth about our faith, give them a solid grounding and the confidence to talk to their non-UU friends about our faith, and give them the commitment and desire to participate and lead. For Eastshore, offering regular, more in-depth adult education classes could provide a way to integrate new members and develop future leaders. So I think it has a lot of potential. Secondly, I now really feel like I understand the concept of centering marginalized groups, whether they're people of color, people with disabilities, LGBTQ folks, young adults, or others. Inviting and welcoming marginalized groups and people into the development of services and ministries, rather than building programs that we think that they would want, could help us welcome and integrate more diverse people into our church. This is a time of huge change in our society, and if we want to stay relevant, we need to learn to innovate, experiment, fail, and keep trying until we find what works best. I hope you'll all support the incoming board and welcome their attempts to try to do things differently, even if they do fail on occasion. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Grace Colton. I attended General Assembly for my second year, and an image was invoked for me at GA's Sunday morning service called Beyond the Water's Edge of Approaching a River. Reverends Joan Javier Duval and Mikhail Slack talked of making our way to the edge of a riverbank. The terrain may be slippery and uneven. It may be hard to move on the unsteady ground, but we go anyway because of what we may find at the river's edge. Uncertainty, surprise, joy, and even death. I began to think of what I had been absorbing at General Assembly in terms of a river of change, with equity, inclusion, and diversity for all on the other side. We are experiencing turbulent times that, like a river, are challenging to move toward, be in, and get through. We need to cross the river. One of many things that got my attention for getting us to equity, inclusion, and diversity for all is looking to our theology as a source of joy. Creatively and faithfully engaging in our theology while examining our spiritual commitment to hospitality, community, covenant, humility, and reparations would allow us to center anti-oppression and liberation, creating conditions we can all thrive in.
And now Donna's going to share about the UU the Vote.
You've heard several members' rich takeaways as veteran GA attendees, but here's the flip side of it. This was my first ever General Assembly of the GA of the Universalist Church, Unitarian Universalist Church. I'm still staggering, trying to catch my breath, but at least I don't have a suitcase to unpack. Instead, I get to unpack a ton of ideas and amazingly tranquility. I had the tranquility I'd lost in this culture of hate and bullying. I've been inundated, overwhelmed. Steve says I can't share more than 200 words, but I can't find a word big enough to tell you how much these 5 days changed my perspective on what I can actively do to change my world. Action trumps organization. No more pacing around, stagnated in my bedlam of indecision, trying to find the best, perfect way to help. Action trumps organization, but only if we just do it. We're given only 120 days before the presidential election. I'm not plodding along through a peanut butter swamp of indecision and self-doubt anymore. I've plunged headlong into blue skies and I'm soaring. UU the Vote workshops gave me several ways I can change my daily routine to work for a kinder, more welcoming America. It hadn't occurred to me to start where I am and play to my strengths. I have a great resource in my family, some 39 first cousins, all raised to value education and spiritual community. Most, if not all, are floundering about trying to find ways to fight the pandemic of hate that is being spread from the top down to our children. I'll offer them, my cousins, the opportunity to do postcards, write letters, or do phone banking to get out the vote. I'm also looking forward to showing my 9 and 11-year-old granddaughters how to write postcards to help people get registered to vote by mail. The girls need to feel empowered in a world of bullies. Our church is preparing to partner in ministry with other organizations to take effective action. We'll participate in an amazing phone banking protocol, letter and postcard campaigns, whatever, all the while practicing hope and fellowship. There's a planning meeting tomorrow night, so stay tuned.
Hi, everyone. I'm Maury Edwards. May I direct you to the 7 principles listed on your screens? I'm exceedingly proud of this list. This is us. This is that to which we aspire. Those of you that know me well know that my current theme song, if you will, is a capacity for more compassion. We're in turbulent times with the twin pandemics of the virus and the horrible killings of on videotape of people at the hands of our police. One good thing has come out of it. Black people are now finally being heard when they say Black Lives Matter. With the deaths of so many at the hands of our militarized police, it's finally being recognized by most that Black people have value, that they're not expendable. Of course, they need more equity in healthcare. They need more equity in their schools. They need access to money and money markets, and they certainly need more safety at the hands of our police. But more importantly, locally, here at East Shore, we need to see our people of color for all of them, their entire selves, not just for what they can do for us or what we have in common, but for their entire self, and accept them as such. Now, this dovetails into an aha moment that I had at General Assembly, which was my first General Assembly, by the way. There was a discussion where they talked about two kinds of relationships. They talked about transactional relationships and transformational relationships. A transactional relationship can best be described as, oh, what's in it for me? What can you do for me? This is the kind of relationship that works well or better in settled times. It demands that things get done at a certain time and a certain way. And common in these relationships is a system of reward and punishment. Recently, in the last year, I had a conversation with someone who said, you know, you need to listen to my viewpoint. And if you can agree with me, we can continue to talk. But if you don't agree with me, be gone with you. A transactional relationship is one based on beliefs, values, and needs, and listening, lots and lots of listening. This to me is spiritual Unitarianism. By the way, this kind of relationship works well in turbulent times. If we truly live up to these 7 principles you see on your screen, we can show Naomi Klein, our AWARE lecturer at General Assembly this year, what she was asking for from Unitarians. Her ask is that we show the world how to do this spiritually. She said, no small steps are needed now. A leap, like in that special time, a leap year, a correction is necessary. That's what's needed. So, capacity for more compassion and transactional relationships. Those were my big takeaways from General Assembly.
Uh, I was most moved by the discussion on how to have tough conversations with white people. Through generations of lies and a culture of dominance that places white America at a distinct advantage over Blacks, Indigenous, and people of color, we have a chance at an awakening. The big takeaway for me was this: let's be willing to learn together and make mistakes together, particularly in the context of growing toward anti-racism. If we hope to be a welcoming church toward all people and really mean it, we'll have to be comfortable enough with each other to be vulnerable by letting go of our assumptions about each other and newcomers. In doing so, we may make mistakes along the way, and this may expose us to some scary feelings of shame or guilt. Being able to navigate between the two could be very useful. June Price Tangney, PhD, writes, "A shame-prone individual who is reprimanded for not including someone in something because of the color of their skin or casting a microaggression with or without malintent might think, 'I'm such a loser, I just can't get it together.' Whereas a guilt-prone individual would more likely think, 'I feel really bad for doing X. I can tell my actions really hurt that person. What can I do to make it better?' Feelings of shame can be painful and debilitating, affecting one's core sense of self, and may invoke a self-defeating cycle of negative affect. In comparison, feelings of guilt, though painful, are less disabling than shame and are likely to motivate us in a positive direction toward reparation or change. In other words, guilt is, 'I did a bad thing,' and shame is, 'I am a bad person.' I cannot speak for anyone else, but I know that my promise to you is that I am learning, I will keep learning, I will make mistakes, and when I do, I will learn and do better. Thank you to Mike Radow, Maury Edwards, Grace Colton, Amanda Strombaum, Leanne Struble, and Donna Duncan for sharing your experiences with us from General Assembly. The varied perspectives you bring to the table help us see the world from a broader lens than our own little bubble and bring us ever closer to a place of greater understanding, hope, and courage to act to create systemic changes that better all people's lives, even in the face of failure. Thank you." For years, I had heard about the amazing music, the wonderful bonding experiences, and the challenging and thought-provoking seminars at GA. It was on our list for so long, but it wasn't actually until it went virtual that it became more feasible for us as a young family to attend. The experience was everything people said it was, with the bonus of not missing anything because I can go back and watch it all summer long. The seminars were rich and varied, and it was a wholly transformative experience that I encourage anyone to go to if they have the opportunity.